This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Race is a social construct that's been pretty well established, but it's a social construct that's still deeply ingrained in American society and culture. We've been talking a lot in this country and on this show about race. We've talked about how police officers in the state of Vermont address racial profiling. We've talked about examining difficult racial conversations through theater. And earlier this summer, we learned about a study that shows that people who say they don't see color are not as well equipped to deal with the realities of their own racial biases. But discussions about race are often only brought up in the context of what we sometimes define as people of color, as if they are the only people with race or identity or racial identity. But if we accept race, even as a social construct, then white people have a racial identity as well. When asked about it, you might say you don't identify with your race, that it's not central to your being or to your self-expression or to your idea of your culture. But each of our experiences with race are hugely contextual. So your ability to not think about your race on a daily basis, maybe because you're a white person living in an overwhelmingly white state, and the ability to blend in or be neutral is an easy one to take for granted. Well, today we want to talk about this idea of white identity and why it might be valuable to spend a moment considering it. Stay with us here as we open up this conversation, and I hope you'll participate even if it makes you uncomfortable. Joining me now is C. Winter Hahn, Assistant Professor of Sociology and Anthropology at Middlebury College, where he studies racial and sexual identity. Professor Hahn, so nice to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
And we're also joined today by Paul Marcus. He's the lead trainer and former executive director of Community Change. That's a Boston-based nonprofit that focuses on the role of white people in addressing systemic racism. Paul, it's nice to have you back on the program as well.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Let's talk a little bit about what we define white as. How are we talking about white identity in the context of what it means to be white? So, Paul, we'll start with you. What is it? What is white and white identity?
Well, that's a somewhat complicated question to answer in a short period of time.
Luckily, we've got half an hour.
Yeah. for me, white identity comes out of a history of, and I won't mince my words here, a history of white supremacy in our nation. Whiteness, as we understand it, is a relatively new concept in human history. When the first recorded case of Africans coming to this shore in 1619 in Jamestown off of a Dutch slave ship, when they landed on this shore, they weren't seen as white. White didn't have this, as black, and white, it didn't have the same meaning. They were treated very much the same way as indentured servants were treated. And then as we go through the 1600s, by the time we get to the end of the 1600s, the inferiority and the ability to enslave blacks and Africans has been codified into the systems of the systems and the laws of the colonies, and it's very clear that messages were being given to whites. The last multiracial, multicultural rebellion in this country was Bacon's Rebellion in the 1680s, and it was very clear to the white planters at that point that's the last thing they wanted to happen would be Native Americans, African Americans, and indentured servants coming together. And you can see through the laws that were written and legislative decisions and judicial decisions that clear messages were sent to whites that you're better than them. And there's all kinds of ways in which that was said. And so right from the beginning, this idea of whiteness was constructed, and it was constructed at the same time that capitalism is developing. And so what we have is this economic need for the enslavement and for labor, and we were enslaving African Americans, and we needed to justify that. So for me, I can't think about white identity without thinking about that history that's built into the fabric of our founding and of our nation and continues with us today.
Professor Hahn, where would you go from there? How do you then pick up the thread?
Now, I think Paul gives an excellent answer, but I would also add that we have to think about whiteness in the contemporary sense as well. That, yes, there's this huge history where whiteness was a category that was constructed in order to control labor. But at the same time, why does it still maintain itself now in a society where allegedly jobs and benefits are not doled out based on people's race, right? So what keeps whiteness a category that maintained itself in today's world? And part of it is that whiteness is something that we have now all sort of bought into to some extent. And it's seen as being this normative category that to some extent, the things that come with being white are the things that we're told is part of the American dream that everybody should try to achieve and everybody to try to strive for. And we can't sort of tease out the history and the contemporary part of what it means to be white and why everybody would sort of see that as the normative group without really thinking about how that impacts people of color in negative ways, as well as white people. We can't leave out sort of whiteness and the negative effects that whiteness has on largely poor whites or white folks who have less advantages in life and have less access to certain things that a capitalist system provides to folks.
Judging by some of the initial comments we got when we posted this show topic on the internet on Friday, this is a conversation that makes some people very uncomfortable. Some people makes them pretty angry. We're talking today about what it means to be white and how white people identify or don't with conversations about race. Here are a couple of representative comments that we got on our show webpage. From Sarah, she says, "This is a joke." From Matthew, "So what's the goal here? To reduce the overall proportion of whites in North America or to spread diversity equally through every backwater of the country? Would you be more comfortable if there were fewer of us here now?" And Harold says, "Let's blame others for our lack of work ethic. It's some folks' reasoning. There are plenty of examples of all races who have succeeded from dismal starts. The more help and money you get from the government, the less you will do for yourself." That being said, we're also getting some pushback on those comments from some of our listeners. Andy says, "This show is called Examining White Identity. What the heck is wrong with that? Where does it say they're going to blame others for their lack of work ethic? No one can deny that this is a very white state. That is not a judgment. That is just a fact. The knee-jerk reactions on the comments of a show that has not even aired yet is really sad." And Kay says, "Get a grip, people. Too many of you have no idea the privileges you have due to being white in America. And in this state, you barely have to think about it. God forbid someone ask you to and you freak out. That's called white fragility, people. You enjoy your privileges by default but never want to examine them. This is an opportunity to take a look at who you really are, which is not a separate and better race, but a group of people who enjoy better treatment due to having light skin." So that should give you a taste of how provocative this concept can be. But we actually want to get beyond bickering and have a really fruitful conversation about why this topic is so difficult and uncomfortable. And we'd like to have an idea of how you see race and culture in your own life. So listeners, if you're white, how do you think about that? And if you're not white, what's your perspective? Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Professor Hahn, what do you think about those dueling comments that we were already getting before the show had even aired this morning?
Well, like you said, I think that those comments that people posted before the show was aired demonstrates how controversial this topic is and how uncomfortable it makes a lot of people feel. But part of that discomfort comes from people feeling like they're being personally attacked or that they're being told that they have advantages that they didn't earn. And, Robin DiAngelo said really, and I'm paraphrasing her, and she said this much more eloquently, that privilege is not the absence of struggle. It's the absence of certain types of struggle. And yet, when we talk about this topic and we throw words around like privilege, we assume that people who have privilege have privilege in all aspects of their lives. And that isn't really true. So we need to clarify that when we talk about having white privilege, no one is arguing that somehow if you're born a white person in this country that everything is magically wonderful for you and you're going to have everything in life just because you're white, because that's not true. Not everyone who's born white has the same access to opportunities that everyone else who is born white has. The issue with whiteness and privilege is that if you're born white, you don't have the privilege, you have the privilege of not having to deal with racism to a large extent. And I know that some people have posted that, you know, that they have also been the victim of sort of racism because they lived in a black neighborhood and their neighbors didn't like them or whatever the case might be. But we have to separate out individual acts of bigotry that people commit against us, which is possible, right? I mean, Asian people could be bigoted towards blacks, black people could be bigoted towards whites, and all of that's possible. But when we're talking about racism, we're talking about a systemic problem. We're not talking about how individuals treat each other, but we're talking about the ways that entire groups of people get treated. And so it's very, very difficult to sort of tell people in short discussions that when we talk about whiteness and white privilege, we're not talking about things that you have as a person. We're talking about things that are systemic, that things that because you are marked as a white person in our country, that you don't have to deal with or that might hold you back if you were born a black person.
Paul, what about you? What are you thinking?
Well, it's I really appreciate that analysis. You know, I can speak to this as a person who is white and grew up in a white working class family. Privileges are things that some people have that others don't. I think privilege often gets conflated with money. I use this example often that when I walk into a building, I'm temporarily able-bodied. I don't have to think about how I'm going to get into that building. I don't have to, are there going to be ramps? Are the bathrooms going to be accessible? If I'm walking in the city, I don't have to think, you know, if I was in a wheelchair, I'd have to be concerned, am I going to have to negotiate curbs or is there going to be ramps? Can I get in the doors? All of those kinds of things. So as an able-bodied, temporarily able-bodied person, though, I don't think about those things on a daily basis. They just don't even come to my mind. And likewise, as a person who's white, there are things that people of color have to think about on a daily basis that I don't even see. So I think it's really important to understand that that's what we're talking about when we're talking about privilege. And, you know, over the last 25 years of doing this work, I've probably asked over 10,000 people how they understand race and racism. And I think it really is important because the vast majority of people in this country understand racism as at the individual, internal and interpersonal level. And it's profoundly transformational for people to go through a process where they can begin to see racism as a system that creates structures that we all live in. And those structures that we live in impact all of our lives. Those structures are all interconnected, and they provide opportunities. They shape our life chances, and many of us are, you know, we're all situated in these structures, but we're not all situated the same way.
Lots of listeners weighing in now on this idea of what it means to be white and to have a white racial identity. Mark says, in terms of white identity in Vermont, I think it has everything to do with what part of the state you call home and the socioeconomic demographic that you're a part of. Rich says, to look forward, we must look back. This is the essence of facing racism in the present. I'm curious if the show will mention the genesis of this state. An entire people was displaced, marginalized, and forgotten to found this bastion of whiteness. It continues virtually unabated today. I refer to the indigenous people of Vermont and this hemisphere. Charity begins at home. How can we hope to address the issues of today when we refuse to acknowledge our past? And let's go to Karen, who's calling in from Glover. Hi, Karen. Go right ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
I had a comment that fits with that a little bit. I have encountered some surveys by Department of Health, and the way they collect demographic information is they ask for a primary race. And the reason I even noticed this, I'm white. I'm Italian-American, English, Scottish, Dutch. I grew up in New Jersey. And I'm living here, and I'm raising a child of color here. So that's the only reason I happen to notice how they collect this information. Because otherwise, I would just be checking white and be done with it. However, I've found that when they ask me for his race, they want me to pick a primary. So I said black, I said Native American, I said white, and they said, no, you need to pick a primary race, or it goes in as unknown. So,
Karen, I'm curious, can I ask you, what would you like to see, and why would it be of value to you to be able to have a broader definition of race, even on things like census forms or health forms?
Well, a broader definition would give people, a lot of people around here, they check white, but then you start talking to them a little more. Well, yeah, I have some Native American ancestry, but they're all checking white on these forms because there's no option to check all that apply. And there's no option to connect to their ancestry or their identity in terms of their ancestry. And it's kind of this broad whitewashing that lumps us all from very diverse countries of origin, very diverse backgrounds, into one group. And it almost erases individual identity.
Karen, thanks for your point. I appreciate it, and thank you for calling in. Let's get another call in here, and then we'll come back to our guest. Sarah is on the line with us from Rutland. Hi, Sarah. What's your perspective?
Hi. I feel that there's too much concentration on the issue of race. If people just live their life and learn to get along with each other, then that's fine. But there's too much dissection. I think that's what leads to all this discussion and animosity. I think things have changed drastically since our current president has been elected. We all thought it was going to change things for the better, but in fact it has gotten worse. And I do want to make one comment. Many years ago, I lived in a mixed neighborhood, and it was actually white was the minority. I was very friendly with an elderly black man who was my neighbor. And he told me one time, he said, you don't belong here. And he didn't mean it in a nasty way. He just said, you just really don't belong here. And I was appalled. So it works both ways. And I am tired of people stirring the pot. Thank you.
Sarah, appreciate your perspective. Let's throw that back to our guests today, Paul Marcus and C. Winter Hahn, as we talk about this idea of white identity. And Sarah's point about why are we talking about this? Isn't this just stirring the pot is one that you hear often. And I heard over the weekend in preparation for this show, this idea of, you know, this is just dividing us even more. Why are you bringing this up? We shouldn't have to define ourselves by race. Why are you asking about white identity? So, you know, I realize this is a show concept that originated with me, but I'd like to throw it back to you because both of you think about this a lot. Paul, how would you respond to Sarah?
Well, you know, that history I was talking about isn't just in the past. That history lives with us. And right now in this country, today, African Americans experience race. African Americans and other people of color experience race viscerally. The historical reality of race is almost part of the DNA. They experience race viscerally. Living in a black body in this country is very different than living in a white body in this country. And when we look at statistics, when we look at the statistics around all of the systems that we operate in, healthcare, housing, jobs, every system I can name, they really haven't improved. In fact, in many cases, since the end of the Civil Rights Movement, many of those statistics have gotten worse. What we don't understand is that we have had a history of affirmative action for white people in this country since its founding. So in 1789, the Congress passed the Naturalization Act that said that white people can become citizens. We have the land being given to white people, millions of acres of land through the Homestead Act in the 1800s, which created a tremendous amount of wealth. Through the middle part of the 20th century, of the $120 billion in subsidized loans from the FHA that between 1933 and 1964, 98.6% of that went to whites. Government policy put that out, built the suburbs, created the wealth of the vast majority of the white middle class. And so that we can't, by not talking about race, there's no pot to stir. The pot's here. And by not talking about race, we can't get around it. And I would argue that any of us who are white are walking through, as with what Peggy McIntosh calls this invisible knapsack of privilege that we're not even aware of. And so race, as a white person in our society, my race impacts me more than any aspect of my identity on a daily basis as I walk through this world, and my whiteness has impacted the lenses through which I interpret reality. And I can't get away from that. It has nothing to do with who I am. It's part of the system that I was born into.
Professor Hahn, I want to get to you. We're going to take a quick break first and then come back. We're talking today about racial identity and how it manifests itself when we talk about being white. That's not something that's discussed much except in the context of talking about other races and racial identities. So today we are examining the concept of what it means to identify as white and if white identity and culture can be defined and talked about. Coming up, we're going to talk a little bit more about why when you say, I don't identify with a race, I'm just neutral or I'm ordinary or I'm normal, what that actually means. And we're going to look at this question of, is it possible to acknowledge privilege, to acknowledge your position in the world, but also to feel pride in your heritage? Certainly the term white pride is not one that has a very positive association. But is there a way to feel some kind of positive feelings towards your heritage? Listeners, we would love to know your perspective on these questions and anything else that's coming up for you as you listen to this discussion. You can post your comments on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net or call 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. How do we define what white is? As the dominant category for so long in this country, white people often think of themselves as just ordinary or neutral or normal. But if we believe there is a black identity or Asian identity, wouldn't it follow that there's also such thing as a white identity? So what is it? And how do you think about it? Maybe even how do you feel good about your racial identity without getting into complicated and fraught concepts like white pride? Paul Marcus is lead trainer and former executive director of Community Change. That's a Boston-based nonprofit that focuses on the role of white people in addressing systemic racism. And C. Winter Hahn is an assistant professor of sociology and anthropology at Middlebury College, where he studies racial and sexual identity. They are helping us through this discussion, and we really want to hear your thoughts on it. If it's not something you've considered before, where do you find yourself in the conversation we've been having? What questions does it raise for you? Where do you find yourself feeling uncomfortable or feeling like you want to be outspoken? And if this is something you've been spending a lot of time with, how do you approach the subject and how do you talk about it with other people? You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your comments on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Interesting conversation going on there. Professor Hahn, I didn't get a chance to go back to you on this question of, you know, are we just stirring the pot by bringing a conversation like this up? But you can start there, or you can tackle this idea of, you know, feeling proud about who you are, even if that also is partly a racial identity.
Sure. I certainly understand the caller sentiment, because the way that the narrative surrounding whiteness has become is the sense of some people have privilege and other people don't. And, you know, nobody wants to sort of be told that you got things that maybe you didn't deserve because of some accidental birth, right? But I would sort of And so this shared belief that talking about race simply is sort of blaming someone else or simply stirring the pot or simply making things worse is an understandable one. But at the same time, I would sort of ask, well, if it's difficult and tiring for you to talk about it, imagine how difficult and tiring it is for people to have to live through it every day. That people aren't bringing up these topics and these issues because they somehow enjoy talking about them. People are bringing them up because there's a serious problem that impacts their lives in very negative ways because we live in a society that's sort of built upon different races and hierarchies of race. So I would ask that perhaps instead of sort of thinking, well, why are they always you know, talking about it, let's not talk about it because it's making things worse. Instead, sort of turn that question around and say, what is the problem that people are sort of bringing up, and how do we then fix those problems? How do we address those problems? And how do we sort of ensure that we don't need to talk about it anymore? Because as of now, for people of color, we need to talk about it because this affects our lives. And so I don't know if that's a good answer for the caller, but I hope that she would think about it a little bit.
Hmm. Let's bring some more people into this conversation, because this is clearly something that's resonating with some of our listeners. Gaia wrote in to say, I very much appreciate this discussion as the adoptive parent of a now adult African-American daughter and also the former spouse of a Jamaican-American man who was clearly the target of racial profiling. My comment, it may not be helpful to talk about white privilege to reach working class people who don't feel privileged and may resent seeing people of color having advantages that they don't feel they have access to. I'm wondering how it's even possible to approach people such as those who flaunt the Confederate flag in St. Johnsbury in a way that is not threatening and can somehow penetrate their well-entrenched prejudices. Let me bring up a couple other callers, and then we'll get some responses again from our listeners. Julia is calling in from North Chittenden. Hi, Julia. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. First of all, I'd just like to address a comment that was made by a woman who talked about how, you know, the demographic information is collected by the state anyway, asked for primary identity. And I do know for a fact that the census, any census survey that's done asks for as many ways that you want to identify yourself as possible. Hmm. So, you know, you have a choice of white, black, or African American. You have a choice of Native American or Alaskan, Hawaiian Islander, et cetera. And you could list all of them if they're in your past. So just wanted to clarify that.
So the census data may be different from state forms for school and education, yeah, and stuff like that. Go right ahead, Julia.
Exactly. I wanted to add that, you know, I wanted to second what has been said about, you know, the working poor white individual or family. I find discrimination on all levels is pretty rampant, whether it's by age, whether it's by gender. You there?
We're here. Do you have something beeping in your background?
Okay. That's just a truck backing up next to me. Okay. But anyway, you know, it's something that we have to tackle throughout. I think black people are certainly leading the charge. It's definitely making everybody think, but it's not like, you know, it's not like all whites are bad and all black people are victimized. I think a lot of it comes down to your economic status. And yes, you may be pulled over as a driver, you know, being profiled, but, you know, there's still lots of opportunity for people who get a good education, who somehow work their way up. They get respect from their peers, and they work their way up.
Julia, I hear what you're saying, and it's an interesting juxtaposition that we're hearing from a couple different callers here, this intersection of race and class and clashing cultures. Let's get a couple more perspectives in. John is on the line with us from Newport. Hey, John, go right ahead.
Yes.
Hi.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
I feel that nature made us different, and we'll always be different. And there's no reason anyone should have to feel guilty about it. And the reason all the white people left Detroit is because they want to be together. They enjoy each other. And that's the way nature is. And there's nothing wrong with that. And anyone that says white people are privileged is totally wrong. Everything white people have achieved has been through hard work and determination. And as far as being black or any other color, it's nature, and that's what it is. And if you go to Africa, they all kill each other over there, and they're all black, and they kidnap each other, and they do all kinds of brutal things. So they shouldn't be blaming white people here for being white. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Well, and John, I don't think that's where our conversation today is coming from, but let me put your point to Paul, because, Paul, you work with people who have this perspective sometimes. So what do you say to somebody like John?
Again, this is a short. We often in teaching in classes and in workshops have the opportunity of some time to bring people through a process. The concept that I briefly spoke earlier about the idea that we live in a system. You know, the concept that white people, implicit in what he said is that white people work hard and people, black people don't. And that was implicit in a number of the comments at the beginning, or explicit, in fact, that in a number of the comments that came out even before the show came out. So there's so much. One of the issues for me, and I appreciate the comment about this, the difficulty of having conversations about privilege are probably not the way to go to have this conversation with white working class people. That's another conversation, but I appreciate bringing that in, but the one of the issues is that we are, as a nation, we are racially illiterate. That everybody has opinions about race and racism, but very few people know much about it. Know much about the history. Know much about the reality. We have a history and a present reality of white people denying the lived experiences of people of color. Oftentimes white people come out and it feels like we're saying we know your experiences better than you do, and so there's so much there to take on. Just the misinformation about what's happening in Africa, the reality that white people are that whites got what they got because they work hard. I don't have a lot to say about that in this short period of time because there's just so much misinformation there.
Ben is calling in from Montpelier.
We say something about the
Chungsukia, you
want the argument the last caller made about mm-hmm. this biology of race?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, go right ahead.
I think that it's a very common belief that people have that somehow, that being white, being black, being Asian, whatever, are these biologically discrete categories, and that people sort of naturally flock to the people that are sort of like them. But if you look at the history of the way race was constructed in our country, we see that the different groups of people who now see themselves as members of the same group really historically did not see themselves as members of the same group. So the caller mentioned that white people left Detroit because they wanted to live together. Well, that's actually not true. That people who are classified as white today left because the FHA loans allowed them to leave and go into more mixed white neighborhoods. But when they were living in Detroit or Philadelphia or New York as white ethnic groups, they rarely saw themselves as being members of the same group. So an interracial marriage was seen as something between an Italian person and an Irish person. That parents were just as opposed to having their Italian daughter marry a German boy. So this idea that somehow all these are groups of people who naturally, biologically have an affinity towards each other simply is not true. And as for people who have, who are killing each other, historically, if you look at all the wars that have happened in the world, it's always been between people who, the vast majority of wars in the history of human beings have been between people who now we categorize as members of the same race. Mm. And so there's no natural biological affinity towards the people who are now in our group. These are sort of constructed affinities that the larger social structure got us to believe that these are the same people as us. And so if you look at sort of the history of even our country, Ben Franklin was very, very concerned about the Irish, who he thought was going to come here and marry white women, that he didn't see the Irish as being white. And yet, sometime between Ben Franklin and today, Irish came to be seen as being white. So we have to sort of look at what is the history of that, and why did it happen, and what implications does it have for everybody who today is not seen as being white.
So, we just have a very tiny amount of time left, but I want to make sure I don't leave this hanging out there. Is it possible to be white and to feel some positive association with that? Professor Han, you were talking. What do you think?
Yes, definitely. I think that people, when they get a sense of history and where they came from and who their people are. But the problem with that is that the people who are today highly identified as white tend to be the people who get the least amount of benefits from their whiteness. So not everybody who is white is equally white. As one of the commenters noted, that being white depends largely on social class and geography, right? And one of the things that we don't talk about is the way that our construction of whiteness negatively impacts poor white people. And so whiteness isn't something that just negatively impacts people of color. It also impacts a good part of the white population.
Well, and that's a good place to...
no one sort of tries to interrogate what that means and who actually benefits from this sort of idea of whiteness.
Well, so, and that's a good topic for us to pick up on the show in a future discussion, because we've certainly heard a lot about that today and a tension point there that is very clearly being illuminated by a lot of our listeners. And I'm sorry that we don't have more time to go into that today, but that is a good point to pick up on in a later discussion. C. Winter Hahn is an assistant professor of sociology and anthropology at Middlebury College, where he studies racial and sexual identity, and his book is called Geisha of a Different Kind, Race and Sexuality in Gaysian America. Paul Marcus is lead trainer and former executive director of Community Change. Thanks to both of you for being on the program.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Thanks for having this conversation.
Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Today we begin our third season of Dorothy's List, a series about the books that are nominated for the Dorothy Canfield Fisher Children's Book Award. Each month this school year, we'll visit with a group of middle grade readers to discuss one of the nominees. The kids themselves get to choose the winning book at the end of the school year. We start this season at Morristown Centennial Library, where a group of middle schoolers are reading Julie Barry's novel, The Scandalous Sisterhood of Prickwillow Place. VPR's Amy Noyes takes us back in time for the Victorian era farce.
The students at St. Etheldreda's School for Young Ladies are there to learn to behave as proper maidens should. The girls' lives are mundane under the care of their miserly headmistress, but despite their dreary situation at school, there's one fate that all the girls agree would be far worse, and that is being sent home. So when their headmistress and her brother drop dead at Sunday dinner, the young ladies decide to bury the bodies in the back garden and keep the murders a secret. Thus is born the scandalous sisterhood of Prickwillow Place. The first thing readers notice about the finishing school students is that they each have a moniker they can't seem to shake. Actress Jane Entwistle reads the award-winning audiobook, and the list of characters is the first thing you'll learn.
Young ladies whom you shall be pleased to meet in this narrative. Dear Roberta Prattley, disgraceful Mary Jane Marshall, dull Martha Boyle, stout Alice Brooks, smooth Kitty.
Summer
Heaton,
readers at the public library in Morristown Louise read Dudley, The Scandalous Sisterhood of Prickwillow Place. We visited them to discuss the book and recorded their questions for the author, Julie Barry. 11-year-old Riley Hughes wanted to know about all those nicknames.
When you were coming up with the names for the characters, what inspired you to choose those names?
We put Riley's question and questions from other young readers in Morristown to author Julie Barry.
You know, that's a great question, and the answer is a funny one. The names that appeared in the very beginning, Disgraceful Mary Jane, Smooth Kitty, they just came to me. I wasn't planning to do that. It just happened. But then as soon as it had happened, I sat back and looked at it and thought, you know, seven girls is a lot to keep track of, and a little label might help the readers keep them separate in their minds.
10-year-old Chandler Follansby noticed that the characters can't shake the nicknames, even as they outgrow them over the course of the story.
How come the characters' titles don't change throughout the book, even though their personalities change?
That is an excellent question. I think there are some times when the labels that are used to describe them are challenged a little bit, especially as the story progresses. But there's a funny thing about names and nicknames is they do tend to stick. Sometimes it seems like your reputation in a group is a hard thing to let go of. And if you are thought of as the one who's bossy, you might always be thought of as the one who's bossy, even after you stop being bossy. And so I think that's why the names stayed the same, even though the girls grew and evolved.
So how did this group of characters go from being proper finishing school girls to being accomplices in two murders? Here's an excerpt from the audiobook that helps to explain.
You want to know what I say? Smooth Kitty asked no one in particular. I say, we don't tell these ravens and what do you call 'ems, coroners. Let's not tell anyone. They stared at each other, Smoldering coals settled in the fireplace, sending up low sparks. Each girl was alone, for a moment, with her private amazement. Smooth Kitty counted her heartbeats as she waited for their responses. "But the bodies will smell," Dull Martha said at length. "Sooner or later, they're bound to." Disgraceful Mary Jane, whose green eyes had lit up wonderfully at Smooth Kitty's suggestion, gave Dull Martha a little rub on the back. "No, darling, they won't," she said. "We'll bury them, right in the vegetable beds." "They'll make a lovely compost," Pocked Louise added. "Perhaps not so much this season, but next season the marrows and squashes will burst with juicy goodness." She scratched her nose thoughtfully. "We'll just have to be careful this fall when we go digging for potatoes." Smooth Kitty's eyes darted from young lady to young lady, watching to see how well her idea had taken hold. She didn't dare congratulate herself yet. She must be sure where they stood. "Never mind potatoes. There'll be a scandal," she said. "An investigation. Each one of us could be under a cloud of suspicion for the rest of our lives." "A black spot," Dour Eleanor intoned. "A blemish upon our maiden purity." "Oh no, surely not," disgraceful Mary Jane replied. "Not for such a trifling thing as neglecting to mention the death of a headmistress and her nasty brother. No one could really be upset over that. It takes much more fun to leave a blemish upon one's maiden purity." "They'll think one of us murdered them," Pocked Louise warned. Smooth Kitty slipped an arm through Louise's elbow. "What I'd like to know, love, is whether or not one of us actually did."
And so the stage is set for the girls' deception. With such an eerie premise, Morristown Children's Librarian Rachel Boer had this question for author Julie Berry.
Were there any points in this book that you got freaked out or scared while you were writing because of all the mysterious deaths?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, I don't think I did. I think because I am sort of the man behind the curtain, if you think of, you know, the Wizard of Oz in the movie. Because I'm the man behind the curtain sort of pulling the levers and making things happen, I'm not as affected by the story as the people who are reading it are. That doesn't mean I don't love it and enjoy it, but it doesn't scare me in the way that, you know, I hope it makes the reader feel a little unnerved.
Burying two bodies, solving the murders, impersonating their headmistress, staying on top of a busy social calendar, and keeping up appearances for prying English neighbors, the young ladies of Prickwillow Place have their hands full. All that prompted this question from 10-year-old Megan Hughes.
Why did you choose for the setting to be in England back in the 1800s? And what inspired you to have it be a boarding school?
Well, I have always secretly wished that I were a boarding school girl in England. I grew up reading so many books that took place in England that for me, especially the Victorian era, the mid to late 19th century, really feels like a magical world where stories are possible. And so I just have always loved the literature that came out of that place and time, and I was eager to see if I could write something that felt like it belonged there.
Be they smooth, dear, or disgraceful, each of the girls discovers that when they band together as a sisterhood, they are capable of solving mysteries, finding treasures, and most importantly, deciding their own fates. Which led 11-year-old Sage Simmons to ask this question that may be on a lot of readers' minds when they finish the book.
Is there going to be a sequel coming?
I would love for there to be a sequel to this book. As of right now, we don't have one in the works, but I love to hear from readers who would like to know more about what happens to this scandalous sisterhood. I am certain that they continue to get into scrapes and possibly even solve crimes. So I hope that we'll have the chance to follow them on another adventure. I think they should take a trip somewhere, maybe to a castle.
Until these young maidens find their castle, middle school readers can delight in the farcical murder mystery that is the scandalous sisterhood of Prickwillow Place. For VPR News, I'm Amy Noyes.
And next month on Dorothy's List, Under the Egg by Laura Marks Fitzgerald. A hidden artistic masterpiece has the potential to save the heroine's life or destroy everything she thought she knew about her grandfather. Here's an excerpt from Under the Egg.
I popped the last raspberry in my mouth and crossed over to the studio's defunct fireplace, where atop a grand marble mantel, a chicken egg sat in a small ceramic bowl. My first official chore in the Tenpenny house had been the placement of that egg. Every morning, Jack and I would gather the chicken's output and select the whitest, most perfect egg of the lot. The rest of the half dozen or so went to the kitchen. The egg of honor went to the mantel. Jack would lift me in his arms, and I gently placed the egg in the bowl made by my grandmother, a woman I knew only through Jack's stories of her skill at the potter's wheel and her fine Scandinavian cooking.
That's an excerpt from Under the Egg, excellently read by People's Academy sixth grader Lila Hancock. Under the Egg is next month's selection in our series Dorothy's List, which is sponsored by the VPR Journalism Fund. Five people have already announced they're running for Vermont's open governor's seat in next year's election, and one of those candidates is Democrat Matt Dunn. He'll be our guest tomorrow at noon to discuss his reasons for running and what distinguishes him from the rest of the field. Tune in for that discussion tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.